Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hi, and welcome to a very special Corona Cast edition of Sentimental Garbage. My name is Karen O'Donoghue, and I'm a writer, a podcaster, and someone who had their usual podcasting schedule upended due to a global pandemic, meaning that I can't be in the same room with any of my planned guests. Joining me is author and extremely game co-host in the upcoming apocalypse, Ella Ruthbridger. Hi!
Hi.
How are you doing?
Hi. I like my promotion. I used to be guest, and then I was aunt of the pod, and now I'm co-host.
I think co-host is befitting of your changing circumstances, right? You've been on so many episodes of this podcast at this point.
I think at the point that we're in an apocalypse, I should be allowed to be co-host for the duration of the apocalypse.
Totally. I think co-host at large, perhaps. It's like you're visiting.
I love to be a co-host at large. And I bought a microphone for this, you know?
You know what? You've invested. Co-host. So for the next couple of episodes, God willing that we are able to work the technology, we are going to be doing something slightly different with Sentimental Garbage. As I already said, all of the guests that I had planned had to cancel because of the law of them not being able to leave their house. We decided to do something. And honestly, like, I know remote podcasts are a thing and people do them, but because remote podcasts depend so much on like knowing another person's kind of conversational cues, you kind of have to know people quite well in order to do them very well. Do you know what I mean? So I didn't want to go walking into strangers' ears with people I'd never met. So I thought I would just ask you to do like a mini series within the podcast of like books we read and talk about all the time and we just want to share with the world, regardless of sort of genre or sentimentality or garbagey qualities.
I'm very pleased to be asked. It's very exciting. I was doing nothing else.
Whole load of nothing.
Whole load of nothing. I was just going to be, I mean, I'm sitting on my bedroom floor right now. My plan was to sit on the sitting room floor if I wasn't here. So, you know, I'm ready and willing for podcasts. And also I like to talk about books. I like to talk about books that are, you know, slightly less sentimental and slightly less garbagey than those we have discussed previously.
Yeah. But like the emotional context is always the same in that I always feel the same level of excited about all of them. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the book that we're going to be talking about today?
We're going to talk about a book called Brother of the More Famous Jack by Barbara Trepido, which is one of those books that people just, when they've read it, they just push it into your hands really silently.
Yeah.
It's like, you have to read this book. You have to read this book. You will love this book. It's very difficult to describe because it's just a book about being in love and then not being in love and then you do some other stuff and then some other stuff happens to you and that's your life.
I think it's the closest thing thematically that we get to like, it's very much a Laurie story from Little Women. Do you know what I mean? It's like the thing of being in love with a family. Ooh. And the thing that you would do anything to be with that family forever. And while you may go away from them to Europe, actually, which is both true in both books, you never really stop being captivated under that spell and finding a home in a family that isn't your own, you know?
I think that's so true. Essentially, there's this family. They're called the Goldmans. They are very cool.
They're very cool, wants to be part of them, and one woman gets to be part of them.
They're bohemian, and they're sexually liberated, but in a way that is very realistic.
Yeah.
In the teenage sons are like, Jesus, do you have to do that, parents? And the parents are really in love, but also they kind of fight a lot.
Oh, and it's just so great.
Everybody's just very real. it feels extremely true and extremely accurate while also being extremely picturesque.
Yes, it's like it's like a complete fantasy, but it's very kind of earthy and gritty at the same time. Let me do a full plot summary.
It's grubby.
Yes, yeah, it is grubby. A full plot summary. Okay. So Catherine is an 18-year-old first-year university student who, after meeting the flamboyant and much older John Millett at a bookshop, is asked to join him for a weekend in the country to visit some old friends. When she gets there, she realizes it's the home of her university professor, Jacob Goldman. What follows is a love story spanning two decades as Catherine attaches herself to various members of the Goldman family, including Jacob's two sons, Roger and Jonathan, as well as his wife, Jane. I think I there's no other book that I love the first sort of 20 pages of more than this book. Because it's one of those wonderful things of like a series of believable coincidences that feel like how real life is. Do you know what I mean?
Completely. And the thing is it a coincidence? So essentially what happens is John Millett, who is the most magnificent skis.
Such really, a skis.
He picks up beautiful teenagers in bookshops and, you realise through the book, has been doing this for something like 40 years.
Oh, yeah, yeah. An ageless pervert.
And he is a pervert. You find out later that he has black satin sheets and he likes women to have baths. Which, you know, listeners, if you have black satin sheets and like women to have baths, you do you. That's fine. Don't pick up teenagers in bookshops and tell them you like the Quattrocento profile, because it's creepy. But he's also
such
charming.
He's such a brilliant creep, but it's like, it's the unique attraction of creepy people, you know?
But also, everyone in this book is horrible in various ways. They are horrible in ways that people you know are horrible. Mm. They are believably horrible. There are no characters who do nothing problematic. Mm-hmm. All characters do problematic things from time to time. They all do quite horrible and depressing things from time to time. Jonathan, who establishes himself very near the end of the book as the great romantic hero of the book. Mm. I think, what's the first thing he says? The first thing Jonathan, the great romantic hero of this book, says is, "Rog, that Poovy Miller has brought a woman with him. Have you seen her? Listen, shitface, this doll is worth a bloody sight more than the Queen's Christmas message." And he's barefoot in his wellies. And then he asks her for her number and she says no. And that's very typical of the way this book introduces characters, in that, you know, he's a teenage boy who's quite horrible. He's about 2 years younger than Catherine.
Yeah.
She doesn't, it's not love at first sight. He fancies her. She fancies his older brother, but also kind of his parents. Yeah. And she's also there as the guest of this much older man.
And this is
basically brought her there to embarrass his friend.
It's so perfect and strange, the entire like setup and all the dynamics that ensue because of this weird setup, which kind of like dictates so many relationships for like kind of 20 years. So what happens is that she goes on a date with John Millett, who's like 40 odd and she's 18, finds it very exciting. She's lived this very suburban life. And then kind of in an Italian restaurant, he's like, "Oh, I'm supposed to be going down to Sussex to meet some old friends this weekend. Will you come with me?" She's never been overnight anywhere with a man. And she's like, "Sure." And she arrives there and has that kind of moment of mortification where she's like, "Oh, this is my university professor and his family. This is weird." But also it's this thing where like she's the same age as their children, but she's being brought in like as a fellow adult. And it's this weird thing because like the boys are very much boys. Like they're like 15 and 17, she's 18, and all of the adults are in their 30s and 40s. So she belongs with them, but she kind of drifts between the two camps all weekend, and it's so strange. And it's like this thing where...
It's also the experience of being, at least for me, that was what it was like for me to be in my late teens. I felt very much like I was a grown-up, and the boys of my age were children.
So I was thinking about this so much today when I was rereading this, and this thing of like, it's so much easier for young women to like be a tourist in the adult world because of our bodies and because of how we're able to dress ourselves and because of our currency sexually when we're very young, as opposed to boys who are sort of allowed to stay children and stay kind of boisterous and sort of like outdoorsy and messy and loud for a much, much longer period of time. Like they can basically choose when to become men.
Yes. And like, do you remember when Roger, who's the older brother who she is in love with, starts writing to her?
Yeah.
And she can't cope with his handwriting. He's gone to Africa as a sort of English teacher, I think. Like
very gap year life.
Foreign language. He's on his gap year. He's on his gap year before he goes to Oxford. And her handwriting is beautiful. Everyone through this book comments on Catherine's handwriting.
Yeah.
The writing of, you know, I can't remember, they say something like, all well brought up women write like that. I
think, yeah, all middle class women write that way. And it's kind of this strange, sorry, if you want to finish your point, please.
Actually, I think I'm just going to read that bit.
Okay.
Roger's handwriting was a shock to me. I had until then made the assumption that all superior people were acquainted with the necessity that calligraphic characters were parallel, thick on the downstroke and joined by upward angles of 45 degrees. Roger's handwriting was small, inconsistent and difficult to read. I therefore revised my opinion to the effect that Roger, as the pinnacle of superior man, had license to make his own manners and that his handwriting was the mark of his magnificent disregard for the standards of the world. The truth of the matter was simply that Roger had lousy, undistinguished handwriting. It was a thing he was no good at. And I love that. I love it. And I think I love it in relation to your point about boys don't have to grow up and girls can pass into the adult world. Mm-hmm. Because she's got the handwriting that Jane has. Jacob points this out later on, that all middle-class women have this handwriting. She's a woman and Roger has the handwriting of a boy and he's no good at writing. And you know, do you remember the part where she goes to the cinema with Jonathan?
Yeah, of course. Because, I remember that part.
She's secretly dating Roger. Roger, for reasons, won't tell his parents that he's sleeping with Catherine.
Yeah, yeah.
Catherine agrees not to tell them. She's not really sure why.
She
sort of wants to tell them to be so that it can be cemented. Like, oh, I am your daughter-in-law.
Yeah.
But Roger won't tell them because Roger is constantly trying to think of ways to rebel against his family. I'm really conscious talking about this, that there's a lot of characters here. There's a lot of names and we haven't really introduced anybody, but that's what it feels like to read this book. So there's Jacob and Jane who are married.
Mm-hmm.
There's their friend, John Millett.
Yeah. Who brings her in.
Yeah. There's John Millett who brings in Catherine, but also was in love with Jane at some point.
Yeah.
But is mostly gay. You know.
Yeah, it's a very kind of like 70s phrasing of being like, oh, he's flexible, he's ambidextrous. It's very like, it's, his sort of sexuality is talked about quite a lot in very interesting ways.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think of John Millett as bi. Do you think of John Millett as bi?
No, it's insane to call him bisexual because it's such a...
John Millett likes power is the thing. That's the thing about John Millett is I get the impression that John Millett doesn't particularly care if it's young women or young men he is taking advantage of.
Yeah, it is. There's this very creepy scene where he takes the teenage Catherine and the teenage Roger out for a drive to Brighton. And she says something like, oh, this kind of avuncular sense of taking me out on a boarding school treat. And like, he sort of, the thing of like, he gets them like steak and chips and sort of watches them as if he were deciding who to take part in first. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of, he loves sort of just like simmering in other people's youth. And he also, even though Jacob is his friend, he loves having this idea that he could take anything that Jacob has at any moment. Do you know what I mean? It's this really weird male power struggle that like overrides this whole lovely bucolic dynamic.
But you do end up loving John Millett.
I love
John Millett.
I love him.
There is no... He is terrible in a lot of ways, but he's a very real person and he has extremely wonderful redeeming characteristics. And I can't tell you what any of his redeeming characteristics are. I just know that I miss John Millett. So a spoiler is that by the end of the book, John Millett is dead in a very undramatic way. I think probably a really useful thing with this novel, before we get really stuck into talking about it, is if I just quickly introduce the characters, because there are so many, it's so sprawling, they're all so interconnected. And when you read it, you don't feel like this is sprawling. You just feel like they're people and families you've known your whole life. So briefly, there is Jacob Goldman, a university professor, his wife, Jane, John Millett, who is a complicated man. We'll talk more about him in a minute, who has brought Catherine in. John Millett has been in love with Jane for a long time and is probably Jacob's best friend.
And sort of weird rival.
Weird rival, best friend. Those are the grown-ups. Jacob, Jane, John Millett, and sometimes Catherine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jane and Jacob have, when the book begins, their son Roger, who is about 17.
Mm-hmm.
Roger is very sulky. He plays the violin. He gets very angry when other people call it the fiddle. He's extremely pretentious, extremely clever. And
he's just such a little shithead.
Extremely beautiful.
But
he's so hot.
Okay, yeah, I know. It's just
he gets less hot, but you have to remember that when he's 17, he's so beautiful.
He's so beautiful
and he can play the violin. Then there is Roger's younger brother, Jonathan, who is about 15 or 16.
Yeah.
Who is just a bit of like a little perv.
Oh, I think this is the key difference why even if both of us were single at the same time, we would like probably never have a fight over a man. Because like I immediately, from day one, from like page three, I was like Jonathan forever. I never thought that Roger was hot at all. I was like this fucking pretentious
little
shit.
He's so beautiful. He plays the violin and he talks about God. I love him.
Whereas Jonathan, he's such a skeezy, filthy little gross pervert, and I'm like, yes.
I love Jonathan. I absolutely adore Jonathan.
We love them all.
Jonathan could get it any time, you know? Jonathan. Yeah. But you couldn't sleep with Roger. Roger, I mean, the whole book essentially is becomes Catherine thinking, Roger, 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 Roger.
Yeah.
But Jonathan's there and Roger will never call me back.
That's the God. So like...
Jonathan starts the book off as in his mid-teens, he's got bare feet in wellies, the most disgusting thing I can imagine.
You can just imagine the sort of clammy suction happening between the sweaty foot and the sweaty welly, do you know what I mean? Such a horrible...
Yeah, and there's this bit, right at the... So the first interaction they have is Jonathan says to Catherine, do you want to come fishing? And she looks at Roger, who has shown no interest in her whatsoever, and is like, no, I will stay here near Roger, who won't speak to me, which is a feeling I distinctly understand.
I get it.
And she claims that the reason she doesn't want to go is because she would have had to put her feet into the wellies, into the clammy wellies with no socks on. And I feel like we're really kind of giving you the flavour of this book, which is very much, it's about wellies and not wearing socks and boys, more than one boy, and being like, oh no, but so I guess it kind of fits into the sentimental garbage mold in that way, in that it is a romance.
Very much a romance, just with several different people across a long period of time. She is very captivated by Roger from the moment she meets him, because he is like incredibly pretentious and he plays the violin and he speaks really archly and he's really mean to her, and
I love him.
He perfectly crystallizes all of these Catherine's very much a person, like she's pretty, she's kind of glamorous, but she really hasn't like come online yet as a human being. And she really hasn't. She wakes up the weekend she goes and lives with the Goldmans, and all of these sort of disparate insecurities that she hasn't even been sophisticated enough to feel yet, which is that she's a bit suburban, she's a bit like, I mean, like her mother sort of has like a matching set of you know, a matching suite of chairs and things, and like there's this horrible scene where she goes back from the Goldmans and then it's like this lovely kind of bucolic, filthy, elegant antique thing, and she goes back to her mother's house, which is like a two up two down in North London, and like how provincial and bougie it is, and how like she has a doorbell that has like a chime, and like
and Roger's like, so horrible about the chime,
so horrible about
Roger's
it, and like,
oh, your doorbell's flat, like,
oh yeah, your doorbell's in D minor, and like, but what Roger does to her then, he crystallizes all of these insecurities about her just being quite facile and quite suburban, and he like really attacks her with them, you know, in that way that like that first bad boyfriend is able to do. Do you know what I mean?
And she really never gets over it.
No, she never
Everything
gets over
she does
it.
For the rest of her life is trying to prove Roger Goldman wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, that's basically, she midway through the book, she sort of moves to Italy and has sort of a passionate affair for many years with like a Italian guy. Yeah, it's like everything she does, yeah, is like, I'm not suburban, I'm actually this woman of the world, I'm this, I'm that. And like railing against, trying to find a woman to grow into and thinking it might be Jane for a while and kind of moving on from that. It's just very real.
The thing is, she does kind of become Jane. But what I love about this book more than anything else about it is the fact it's structured in this totally mad way.
Yeah.
The first half of the book is written, the first two thirds of the book are written in the past tense, of which most of which is just her meeting this family.
Yeah.
And becoming incredibly close to them. You don't really get to see her becoming close to them. You get to see her meeting them. And then she says something like, and Jane became my dearest friend.
Yeah. They go to the theatre together. They go out in the town together and stuff. And then she's dating, yeah, simultaneously dating her sons.
Yeah, but in secret.
Yeah.
And then she goes to Italy, where she falls in love with a fascist.
Yes.
He is a fascist. There's no attempt to make that better in the book. She's just like, well, he was a big divorced fascist. He loved fascism and hated women.
I loved him.
And that was sexy. And the thing is, does she love him? I think she thinks it's very sexy.
And she loves sex.
She loves sex. She loves sex and she loves clothes.
She loves sex and clothes. And it's so lovely to just have a heroine sometimes who just loves sex and clothes.
And she's very smart. And she's very smart. And she's smart in a way that I love, in that she'll just like casually mention something from Jane Austen or just casually quote a bit of Dante. But she'll always do it in this context of, she says right at the beginning, I have a consuming love affair with clothes.
Yeah.
And she describes what she's wearing all the time.
Totally.
When John Millett first meets her and she's wearing the purple football jersey that barely covers her knickers and a sort of net vest and a little hat over one eye.
And she refers to it as like, I can put together a suitably voguey look. It's like it's so kind of old fashioned. And like, what's really nice is because like it's a very literary book. And I actually, while I have a physical copy, it is a book that I always put on audiobook. I have it on my Audible account and like I re-download it all the time. And it's really, really well performed. I really recommend it because it is a book that is much better spoken out loud because of it's written in a really homey yet very literary way. Like, you trip up over words. I do anyway. And it's like words I don't recognize where I'm like, meh. But it's really nice that in like quite a literary, quite packed out sentences book that you get this heroine who's like young and blonde and sexy and loves clothes and sex. Do you know? She's not like this cold, awkward brunette. Do you know what I mean?
No, and she's not timid or shy, and she's very hot, and everyone tells her all the time, and she's like, I know.
I know. Yeah,
I mean,
well,
I disagree.
Really,
I hate
literary
this
books.
On audiobook. I hate this on audiobook and love it to read, but then it's written for me basically in the way that I think it's like just downloading extra bits of my brain.
Really?
The style of writing feels very like this, it feels very natural to me the whole way through.
I think it's one of the, I think the writing style and the voice is really specific, and it's like it's this weird, I don't know, there's probably lots of literary terminology for what the style is, because it's like both very simply and Enid Blyton-y, but also like very packed with all of this like really detailed, like really florid language. Well, you know what I mean? It's like this weird contrast.
I just think she's a genius. I just love this book so much. And it is so dense and there's so much in it, and everyone in it is complicated. but not in a way that feels contrived. They're complicated in the way the people you love most are complicated. And I just think it's a really beautiful, very funny, very smart book about how you can love a lot of people in a lot of different ways. And she never really gets over Roger, but fine.
Yeah.
No one gets over their first love. Like, that's what being in love is.
That whole... And
she doesn't really get over John Millet. I mean, she's kind of still thinking, but when she hears right at the end, she literally just hears that he's died. This character who changed the course of her life. You just hear, she says something like, "Where's John Millet?" And someone else says, "Dead, lung cancer."
Yeah, and that's
and
it.
And that's it.
Pretty yeah. Long.
And that's it. And she's sad because he was important, even though he was an old perv and tried to give her bath and make her have sex with him on black satin sheets.
Yeah.
And she's sad. And, you know, Jonathan, who is sexist, and Roger, who is just the world's most pretentious man. He's so cruel.
He's such a cruel, I don't know,
I kind of wanted to read a bit of her and Roger, because I think it's so nice. "We walk across the field to the right of the house towards a stream. Beyond the stream, which we cross, is a rather morbid little chicken battery belonging to the neighbouring farm, and alongside that, a blackberry wilderness where we pick and eat. Jane says you can get blackberries without thorns," he says, as he examines a scratch on his wrist. "She's going to grow them." "Have you always lived here?" I say. He shakes his head. "Since I was 5, he says. He hands me some blackberries, which he has picked from beyond my reach. "We used to live in Belsize Park. Where do you live?" "Hendon," I say. "I take my cat to the vet in Belsize Park." "We used to live on Haverstock Hill," he says. I grow silently desperate, thinking that Roger will be gone in 4 days and all we do is have these dead-end conversations. Suddenly Roger says, "Once John and I were picking blackberries in Oxford, in my grandmother's garden. We tried an experiment to prove the existence of God because the grandparents had been converting us. We were about 4 and 7, I think. We kept muttering abuse to the Holy Ghost to see if the wrath of God would come down. The neighbours heard and told us. I've never been so embarrassed in my life. My grandfather tried to make us pray for forgiveness. I wouldn't do it. I couldn't." "Isn't praying embarrassing?" I say. "Isn't it excruciating?" "At least C of E's do it with a book so there's an end," Roger says. "Quakers go on forever when the spirit moves them. Our headmaster was a Quaker." He gives me another handful of berries. "Pentecostals do it to a Wurlitzer," I say. "Get moved, I mean. I heard them on the radio." I walk 6 feet in the air for noticing that I have made Roger laugh. As we walk back to the house, as I try not to break a leg in my silly shoes, I think admiringly that I have taken berries from the hand of one who does not balk at performing experiments upon the Almighty. It's just, have you ever felt, I want to compare it to Georgia Nicholson. That's the only other book where I read it and I'm like, I know, but it's like, that's exactly what it's like having conversations with boys you have crushes on when you're 18. And you're just like, I've got to say something. And you're just like, I used to live near Hendon.
I take my cat to Belsize Park.
I take my cat to the vet in Belsize Park. It's such a perfect thing. I'm like, why did I even say that? What do I?
And it's like, it's this beautiful thing. Because that is like, they have this romance that goes on for like, I'm going to say a couple of years, maybe. And the whole time of it, he's... this part with the blackberries is basically the only nice moment of that romance. And the entire...
And it's not even that nice.
No, it's not even that nice. They're never really very happy with one another. And she's just constantly trying to please him and trying to get access into his world and into his heart. And she's just never allowed in.
And he doesn't even like her very much. And he's always having sex with her in horrible places. There's a bit where she says, "If Roger could have screwed me on a bed of nails, he would have done it."
And that's the thing. And he's like this person who's like completely like so married to the idea of like rebelling against his parents. And his parents are so sensual and so sensory. And like, it's like he won't even let himself enjoy sex because that's the thing his parents do, you know?
Whereas Jonathan is just like all over it. There's a bit where Jonathan takes her to the cinema because Jacob says, "Roger, take Catherine to the cinema." Roger won't do it because then Jacob might twig that he and Catherine are sleeping together.
Yeah.
And so Jonathan ends up doing it, driving illegally someone else's car without a license, because Jacob is so obsessed with the idea that someone should take Catherine to the cinema, because he's like, why are neither of my sons sleeping with this woman? And they go to the cinema. And oh, I know why we started talking about the cinema in the first place. Because they go to the cinema, Catherine's a grown-up, mm-hmm. and in the cinema are loads of Jonathan's enemies from school, who are just like, that fag Jonathan Goldman's here with a girl, what's going on? Oh, yeah. And they start throwing things at them. And then Catherine's just like, what's happening?
It's that thing, that shifting between worlds thing, being like, I get taken to Italian restaurants by men in their 30s and I go to university. And now here I am with a 15-year-old at the cinema getting like popcorn thrown at me. Like, what? It's like this weird shifting world
thing.
Which
is exactly what it's like to be a teenage girl.
Yeah, and specifically that late teen, like 17 to 19 gap of like...
Very much. And it was very much my experience. So, you know, I didn't meet the Goldmans, but I met a lot of people, and lots of people who seemed to me to have excitingly bohemian lives. Mm-hmm. And that thing of being like, oh, I'm a grown-up, like particularly with men who were older. Yeah, like, oh, I'm out to dinner with a man who's 34. This is incredible.
And it's that thing that every single woman, every single woman falls into the road of, no matter how many women do it, is that thing of like, I'm 18, out with a 35-year-old or a 30-year-old or whatever. I must be the most sophisticated 18-year-old there's ever been, when the reality is he is the most fucking infantile pervert person that's ever lived. Do you know what I mean?
It's amazing, isn't it? Because definitely... I had heard people in their late 20s and early 30s talking, as we are talking now, about men in their 30s going out with girls in their late teens. And I was just like, oh, that must suck for those girls. But for me, the most mature teenager in the world. God, it's why it's so good that Catherine eventually chucks in Roger Goldman. Or she doesn't. Like, eventually Roger dumps her. No, sorry, I've got completely muddled. Why it's good, I think, that John Millett essentially just has to fade into the background.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no sense of like, oh, the deep romance between Catherine and John Millett. There's just a sense of like, these things happen. Very much this is a book where it's like, ugh, bad things happen. What are you going to do? It's like there's the middle of this book when she's in Italy is mm-hmm. profoundly traumatic. It should be. If it was any other writer, it would be the crux of her life and the thing that everything revolved around and came back to. Mm-hmm. I don't know how we do spoilers on this podcast, but people have read the book.
Yeah.
I'm going to say something vaguely spoilerish now, because I think it's important that we address it. She has a baby with Michelle. Michelle? Yeah. I don't know how you say his name.
I've been saying Michelle.
Michelle, the divorced fascist. He's much older than her. He's got two little boys who are very bored by her, and she is very bored by them. She gets pregnant. He tries to force her into having an abortion by buying her a mink coat that he then makes her give to a homeless woman to try and pressure her into having an abortion. She won't have an abortion. She has the baby on her own, and then the baby dies.
Yeah, it's just caught death, isn't
Yeah, she is so happy to have this baby. She loves this baby so much, and then the baby dies, and...
And also, not only does the baby die, but her labour is extremely traumatic. It's like
she's
in hospital
labor
for days, all that kind of stuff. Like, she refers, like, Jonathan Goldman later refers to her as, like, your patchwork fanny. Because she's all
no
scarred down
sex.
There. Yeah.
There is no more tender sex scene in history than Jonathan and Catherine having sex for the first time.
It's lovely.
When
it's
she
so
has
lovely.
Just had... She's like... 3 months out from this terrible labor, like 2 months, like a month, 2 months after the death of her baby, and she's so vulnerable, and all he does is love her.
Yeah,
he doesn't, and like, you know, and it's not like, it's very sexy. He's very like, I must have sex with you or I will die. Yeah. I mean, I think he literally says that in much more graphic terms that I really hate to repeat. But it's very sexy. But he's also just like, let's. Like, I must have said, and it's just so lovely. It's so tender, and he's so nice to her. And he's such a contrast to Roger, who, inexplicably, she still kind of has a thing for.
Yeah, it's that thing of, like, never quite getting over your first love or your first heartbreak thing, right? The person who And I think everybody feels that way in a sense. Like, definitely the first person who dumped me, I still, like, practice conversations within my head, even though I've fucking no clue where they are now. And I'm with a much, much nicer man.
But
it's this thing of, like, not only is he her first heartbreak and he's awful to her, but as I said before, this kind of thing where everything that she doesn't like about herself is completely personified in Roger's rejection of her. Of, like, he thinks that she's really facile because she's just really into, like, nice things and having a nice time, and he just thinks that's so base. He finds her very base, and he associates her with his parents so much, who are like both in this lovely thing that you never see anywhere else, which is like they're so intellectual and cultured, but they also are so base. And I really just wanted to read this bit from very early on in the book when she meets him for the first time. Hang on, I'm just trying to find it. So this happens when she arrives at the house for the first time, and Jane, who already has 5 children, is pregnant with another child. So John says, "Hey, Jake, your wife is pregnant. What's the matter with you people?" "We like fucking," Jacob says. The word drops like a rock onto my uninitiated sensibilities, but does nothing to shake his wife's composure or John's. "Don't be evasive," John says. "I want to know what's the matter with you. 4 children, I accept, is perhaps not an intolerable number, but I can't appreciate that nobody could have predicted twins. And I can appreciate that nobody could have predicted twins. But 6? Why do you have 6 children?" Jacob won't be drawn, sensing perhaps a degree of unwitting prurience in John's insistence. "I like to get her knickers down," he says. "I like her, for Christ's sake. She's my lawful wife." And it just kind of goes on like this. And like it goes on and it's like, and Jane is like, "If you want the truth, John," she says, "you won't get it from Jake. I'm pregnant because it seemed a delightful idea to him and me after we'd blown all the twins' birthday money last winter on an extravagant drunken lunch. I'm afraid it impaired our judgment." You know, it's like, it's everyone's dream of just like having this like, I mean, certainly it's not everyone's dream, but certainly mine, of like having this beautiful, gorgeous house that's just so full of life and energy, and you have these kids who you actually like them for who they are, and they like you for who you are, and you and your husband just still love fucking each other all the time. You know what I mean?
It's just such a dream. They just like each other.
Yeah.
She's
my lawful wife, for Christ's sakes, you know?
They just like each other. And there is so much of that in this book. It's a very honest book in that I was just thinking about, there's so much trauma in it. Or yeah. There should be. In that she has this encounter with John Millet, who is a pervert, but then so did Jane, and later on so will Rosie, who is literally a baby when the book starts, which gives you some idea of John Millet's range.
Yeah.
And then she has this dead baby, this baby who dies, and she has this relationship with Michelle, who's a fascist and is essentially quite abusive to her, and Roger, who is just horrible. And also, Jacob is a Holocaust survivor.
Yeah, which is a very small part in the book, yeah.
I mean, it's a very small part of those
things. But...
And also, Roger insists on wearing his grandfather's hat, and his grandfather was killed in the Holocaust. And everyone's like, "Roger, why do you want to wear a dead man's hat?" And Roger's just like, "It's cool, man." She is incredibly clear on when Catherine is anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
Catherine, not often, but sometimes just like, "Oh, I thought anti-Semitically." And the Goldmans themselves, Jonathan's got a very weird relationship. He's always calling his father like, "Oh, you big yobbo Jew."
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Constantly.
They're just constantly talking about it, which I find very realistic in that it's like, these people are not woke. There is nobody woke in the book, even though they are all...
Hugely compassionate,
and everyone has depth. It's what we keep coming back to, is that John Millet is a pervert, but also you're so sad that he's dead. So there's a... Caroline and I have a house that we refer to always as John Millet's house,
yeah,
on almost no evidence. And every time we walk past the house that we've decided is John Millet's house, I'm like, oh, poor John Millet.
Poor John Millet,
a fictional pervert.
That is how real these people are to me and how well drawn they are. Because it does mention at some point that, like, because we walk in Greenwich Park every day or most days when it's not quarantine.
When we don't do... We used to walk in Greenwich Park in the days before the war.
The days before the war. And it's mentioned in passing that he lives on Greenwich High Road. And just any time that... I don't know, we've just found this house that we've decided is definitely his house, and that's just it. It's almost like, I almost feel like it's a family friend that we had that were just like, ah, yeah, remember when he used to live there? Do you know what I mean?
That's exactly it. They're all so real to me. I think about, I can see them all. And I'm not really a very visual person. I don't think of books in terms of pictures, really. But this, I think about it so naturally in terms of pictures that it doesn't even occur to me. I'm thinking about it in terms of pictures. Yeah. I can see them like I know them. I can't see Jane very clearly. But I think, honestly, because in my heart, I'm like, I am Jane. Because do you think you're Catherine?
No.
When you read this, do you feel like Catherine?
No, not at all.
Because I never do. I always am just like, I'm on my way to Jane.
Oh, yeah. That's the real... Yeah. And that whole thing of her just sort of casually giving birth on the same weekend she meets her, that she just sort of has this very casual home birth, and like there you literally see her placenta and everything, and she's just had it, you know, and this is it.
Yeah, and when Catherine goes home to her mother and she's trying so hard to say nothing about the weekend.
Yeah.
I'm gonna find it because it's so good. My mother had missed me. That was obvious, and I had not given her a thought. Did you have a nice time? She said. Yes, I said. What did you do? She said. I had been deflowered in a hotel room, and I had taken blackberries from the hand of a beautiful young man who played the violin and routed the Holy Ghost. I had seen a human placenta and a newborn baby. I had learned about crochet hooks and copper clamps in the cervix and egg yolks in the soup. I had found an older woman to emulate and admire in place of my mother. I watched Ava Gardner on the telly, I said. Is that all? She said. I went to the seaside in Brighton, I said. I missed you, she said. And then some more text that I won't read. It was my professor's house, I said, loosening up excitedly. The one who interviewed me. His wife had a baby last night. She had it in the bedroom. It got born in their bed. Between the lines of what I said, my mother read the message. The message was rejection, and it made her hostile. What next? She said tightly. When you get to having a baby, you'll realise the place to have it is in hospital. And
there's a bit that just that, towards the end of that passage as well, where it's like her mom, who's just very prudent about everything, is just like, well, shouldn't you have left when you knew that the baby was coming? And there's this lovely line where it's like, mothers are always afraid that you don't know how to act with your own friends. You know, that thing of like, she's so afraid that Catherine's going to commit some kind of like, I don't know, some faux pas of like this like very strict middle class politeness while she's with other people. And it's so constraining, you know, it feels so airless, everything in that house.
It does. And then there's this line just in the middle of the description of the airless house where Catherine says, well, the eye voice says, my mother would have gone to the ends of the earth if I was dying. And once she did.
Oh, yeah.
And like, she loves her mum. And like, her mum has this very small life. And yet Catherine loves her because she's her mother. Mm-hmm. And because she loves Catherine. And I feel... it's just a book about loving people despite all their flaws and because of all their flaws and in all their weird, rich human complexity.
And it's just so much about kind of like urges and passion and sort of the kind of untamable side of yourself as well. Like there's this wonderful bit I always think about where she's talking about her relationship with Michelle and about how he's so kind of weird and passionate and violent and strange, and he always thinks that she's cheating on him. He thinks like there's this part where like she just misses Jonathan Goldman when like she's out somewhere with a friend and she comes home and she finds out that Jonathan Goldman was there waiting for her but then moved on again, and then like, you know, Michelle goes crazy because who is this Jew who's come to see you, because he's a horrible fascist and everything. And this bit where she like almost... You spend like 35, 40 pages with their relationship and it seems fucking nuts. And there's this bit where she's just like, I know this sounds like it was hard to deal with, but actually, like, he never tried to change me. And she makes this wonderful reference to The Taming of the Shrew, where she's like, the girl in Taming of the Shrew never becomes tamed. What she gets to do is she rejects the sort of humdrum existence that her father and sister put on her, and what she gets to do is like do mad mental things with Petruchio and then leaves Venice 100 crowns richer. Do you know what I mean? She's like,
it's true, and she gets to be funny.
Yeah.
But that's, I think, really, I'm really glad you brought this up, because I think that is one of the most telling things of Catherine's voice. Like, she's obsessed with clothes, you know, she loves sex. They have so much sex. Everyone in this book is having sex all the time, or they're thinking about it. Catherine is always thinking about sex. Yeah. And yeah, she's also always thinking about, like, this is just like the Taming of the Shrew, which, by the way, no one understands as well as me, because I am very smart.
Yeah.
And like, but that's very Jacob's attitude, isn't it? There's a bit where he interviews her for the position. And this is also complicates the John Millet thing, because he comes home and tells Jane that he's met a brilliant undergraduate who he's going to enjoy teaching, who also has the best legs since Marlene Dietrich.
God.
Which, you know, and also, like, they're all perving on teenage girls all the time.
Yeah.
And they're just doing it. And that's it. And it doesn't make any of them worse characters.
No.
They're just very real. They're very real, very vivid, very important people to me. And yes, they do things that are not good. And they say things that are not nice. And they behave in ways that are not nice. But they are my friends. And I love them. And I don't think there's any way that a book can feel better than that.
Yeah.
The best thing a book can be is to be like, here are your friends and you love them.
Yeah, yeah. And it is that thing of like, because the book isn't, as you were saying about the structure earlier on, about it being like two-thirds of like, here is just like me being in love with this family. And then there's like a quite like, it just kind of zooms forward and it's like, here's me spending 12 years in Italy. And then here's what it's like once I got home from Italy. And her kind of finding her way back.
And also the tenses shift. That's, and in the only section written in the present tense is when she comes back from Italy, which is like, it's chapter 38.
Yeah, it's weird.
When the book suddenly shifts into the present tense and it's like, and then I came home from Italy. And then she goes to the psychiatric ward.
Yes, like because she's so fucked up from her traumatic birth and death of her child. Yeah.
Which is reasonable.
Reasonable.
And then the reason she gets to leave the psychiatric ward is because they're trying to get them to knit dish towels. And she's like, if you give me another pin, I'll do you a cable knit border. And the psychiatrist is like, go home. Go home. If you're bored of knit dish towels and you're already trying to explain to me how to do a cable knit border,
yeah,
you could go home and do knitting at home.
Yeah. It's so weird how, like, I'm just thinking, like, there's that phrase that they often use in fan fiction, which is like with the Mary Sue character, right? Like a character who comes in and is like, not only are they beautiful, but they're also smart and they're also good at everything. And like, why is it that like Catherine avoids the Mary Sue thing despite occupying so many of those traits?
Because she's real and she's kind of stupid. Like, stupid in ways like we can all see that Roger's never going to be nice to her.
Yeah.
I think it's just because she's real. She feels like a person who I love very much, but she's not me and I don't want to be her.
Yeah.
Mary Sue is where it's like, and you feel like the author wants to be that character, and you don't feel like Barbara Trepeter wants to be Catherine. You feel like Barbara Trepeter loves Catherine.
Yeah.
As we all love Catherine. She's so good. She's so smart and so funny.
So smart.
But she doesn't want to be her. She's just a real person. I feel about Catherine much the same way I feel about you. My dear, dear friend. Very smart, very beautiful, very good at stuff, very interesting life. But, like, I don't want to be you. I just want to be near you and hear about your adventures.
That's the sweetest thing anyone's ever said.
Do you know what I mean, though? Like, I feel like Catherine would be an excellent addition to this podcast. I feel like Catherine would be an
She'd
excellent
be a great
addition
guest.
To our walks.
She would be a great guest.
In real life.
Yeah, she'd have really smart things to say about books and sex. And I'd love that.
I'm very, yeah. I think she would come on a podcast, really. I can't really see her doing it.
No, if we could convince her, yeah.
But she would be a good friend. She would fit very nicely into our friendship group. And I think that's why she's not a Mary Sue, because you're like, well, she's just another person I know.
Yeah. Can I read a bit from the book that always makes me cry?
Yeah, but I don't want to cry.
Yeah, I don't know why it does. So it's basically where she's, like, Jonathan is finished school. He's going touring Europe. Roger has broken her heart. Katharina has decided that she's going to move to Italy because she can't stand being around the Gullmans anymore because it's too painful for her. And she says, You must know that I'll miss you all terribly. Jane has been very important to me, Jake, I said, tears welling in my eyes. Tell her that our kitchen has been my other university. Jacob laughed. I will, he said. I fell upon his hairy chest and cried like hell. Jacob kept patting my shoulder. If you're in trouble ever, you'll reverse the charge on the phone, he said. It's an easy thing, Catherine. Pick up the phone, yeah? Reverse the charge? I'll remember that, I said. Good, he said. And don't you let any of those Catholic bloody foreigners grind you down. When I next saw Jacob, the hair in his chest had turned completely white.
Oh, God.
And it just murders me, because it's like this thing of like... And he's such a kind of cavalier person. He's not like quick to show his affection for people. And he just, the fact, just grabs someone who he now at this point sees as a daughter to be like, if you're ever in trouble, you will call. And that awful thing of like, she does get in trouble and she doesn't call. And by the time that she's well enough to be able to reach out for them again, they've moved house. And she can't, and like the idea, and there's this bit where she's like, The Goldmans don't move. I move, and then I come back to them and voice my insecurities on them. Like, how could they move? And she has to like go through several things in order to track them down again. And the idea that like people who could be so close to you could just fall away—it's almost like a war happens in the middle of the book. It almost feels like a war book where it's like, oh, and then World War II happened, and we didn't see each other for 10 years. Do you know what I mean? But it's not. It's just life.
Yeah, it feels like that. But nothing happened. It's just life, and that's the thing about this book. And I think the weird structure makes that so much more important. The weird structure makes it feel like these things happened. These things happened, and then I went to Italy, and not much happened in Italy for 8 years, and then I got pregnant, and stuff happened again, and then I came home.
Yeah.
Except it wasn't home. I went back to my mother's, which was still suburban, but also now I loved her more because I had had this traumatic thing and she had helped me. Yeah. And I realized that she had loved me. And also I wasn't 18 anymore. And
the more I think about this, the more it really is exactly Laurie from Little Women of like, I was in love with one of you. I left to go to Europe and I came back and I was in love with the younger one.
It's very true.
Yeah.
But I like these much more than the Marches. No, I love Little Women. Same. Don't shout at me. But I love the Goldmans. I love their dirt. I love the way that they're... I love the way that Jane and Jacob kind of fight, but also still fancy each other. I love their sort of mass of children.
Yeah.
I love how casual they are with how in love they are. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Nothing will threaten their romance. They're in it for the long haul.
Yeah, they're so...
And you get the sense... John Millet has tried to threaten that marriage.
So much. So consistently over such a long period of time. Like, basically the only reason he brings Catherine to that house is because he wants to, like, he's kind of trying to threaten Jane with a kind of a younger model and be like, maybe she'll sort of get jealous and kind of come to me somehow. Do you know what I mean? He wants to win her and she's unwinnable, you know?
She's unwinnable. But that doesn't mean that Jane and Jacob have a perfect marriage because... There's a bit where Catherine realizes what a toll being married to Jacob must be.
Yeah, yeah.
On Jane. So the book opens with Jacob's preface.
Oh, can we just read the first bit? It's so good.
Yeah,
it's my favorite first page of any book, I think.
Chapter 1. Since I have no other, I use as preface Jacob's preface, which I read sneakily 15 years ago when it lay on the Goldman's breakfast table amid the cornflakes. I cannot in good conscience give the statutory thanks to my wife, it says, for helpful comments on the manuscript, patient reading of drafts or corrections to proofs, because Jane did none of these things. She seldom reads, and when she does, it is never a thing of mine. Going by the lavish thanks to wives, which I find in the prefaces to other men's books, I deem myself uniquely injudicious in having married a woman who refuses to double as a high-grade editorial assistant. Since custom requires me to thank her for something, I thank her instead for the agreeable fact of her continuing presence, which in 20 years I have never presumed to expect.
And then it just says, it was a marriage characterized, among other things, by the fact that Jacob was alternately infuriated and enchanted by Jane's resolutely playing the country wife. There is no doubt that it influenced the paths that I chose to tread. So literally she says on page one, she's like, I have spent my life trying to emulate this marriage and with good reason, you know?
Yeah. And then, but the thing is, when you look at the end of the book where she really, she digs through that preface and If you haven't read the book, stop listening for this bit. Just take your headphones out and just do something else for like 40 seconds. But she says, this is the last paragraph of the book.
Yeah.
It's devastating. I've thought of times of Jacob's preface, which so impressed me, because since then, Jonathan has given me a mention in his own. Jacob's is, of course, a pretty piece of dishonesty through and through. As always, he has a cake and he eats it. It manages, under the guise of a pretty compliment, to shake shots both at his fellow academics and at Jane. What he is really saying is that his colleagues have inferior wives, poor humdrum creatures who edit and annotate, while his own wife is a goddess who is above such things. What he is saying also is, damn it, Janie, why the hell can't he be a proper wife to me? The greatest dishonesty of all lies in his assertion that he never presumed to expect her continuing presence. Of course he did. He took it for granted, as he took for granted that the milk and the guardian came round at breakfast. Jonathan's mention of me, by contrast, says only, my thanks to Kath, whose earnings have kept me in socks. This is a book about marriage. It's a book about what a marriage can be and what relationships, exclusively, I think, between men and women can be. It's not interested in other kinds of relationships, really. It's interested in the romantic relationship between men and women. Yeah. And all the permutations of those. Because, you know, Jane and Catherine's friendship is enduring, but it's not really important. Because for all of them, it's how do you relate to men? How do women relate to men? And how do men relate to women?
Yeah.
With sex in the way. It's that Harry Met Sally thing of men and women can't be friends.
Oh, it's very When Harry Met Sally. Yeah, you're dead
it's
right.
It's very When Harry Met Sally. It feels very Nora Ephron-y to me.
Yeah.
It's like a very English God. Nora Ephron. And the whole book is concerned with this question of, really, what's a marriage? What's a marriage? What's a relationship? How do we have one that is functional?
Yeah, and how can you be in a marriage and stay yourself? Do you know what I mean? How can you be true to any sense of the self if you are in a unit? Do you know what I mean? And it's a question people have been asking for hundreds of years, you know?
Yeah. For me, I know you've not read Dorothy Sayers' Gaudy Knight, but for me it feels like a cross between Gaudy Knight and When Harry Met Sally, which is what I would put on the cover if they asked me to do it on the cover, which they won't because Rachel Cusk has done that. And she's quite important. But if they're trying to rejack it, Brother of the More Famous Jack, I will happily sell it to people who love Nora Ephron and Golden Age Detective Stories.
Oh, very good. Very good. I would love for, like, I honestly don't really want a film or TV adaptation of this book, but I think it would be worth Nora Ephron coming back from the dead for. I think she would just get it.
If Nora Ephron could come back from the dead, that would be fine. I would like that.
That would be fine.
That would be fine for me. But who would you even cast? Catherine's quite easy to cast.
I mean, for me, Jacob is always Alfred Molina. Who is, he's the Count in Chocolat.
Oh, yeah. That's I'm going to Google it. I'm going to Google these people because I never know what anyone looks like.
Yeah. I guess for Catherine, like, she's probably a little too old
now.
Oh,
that is Jacob!
I know, right?
Oh, that's Jacob! There he is, Alfred Molina. I co-signed this casting.
Yeah. For Catherine, I would do, like, a young Carey Mulligan, I think.
Yeah, great. Beautiful, smart, clothes, like, wears clothes well.
Yeah, and also kind of, it follows a similar pattern to that movie, An Education, as well, which she's very
good. It does.
Yeah,
it does. I really like that film. I really like that movie also, yeah.
Yeah. And then for Jane, probably because I'm thinking of An Education now, Rosamund Pike, I think, would be really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that, with dark hair.
Yeah. And I think for Roger, I would do that guy who played the oldest Stark on Game of Thrones, Richard Madden, I think. Yeah. Oh God, I kind of want it to happen now, even though I know people would hate it and like complain about there not being enough plot
beats. Maybe I'll write it. Maybe I'll write it. Maybe that'll be my lockdown project, is trying to write a screenplay for Brother of the More Famous Jack. A book, it would have to be telly, I think, though, because...
Yeah, telly, definitely.
But then, if you think about When Harry Met Sally, that's a weird disjointed timeline as well. It's
that's
broken up
true.
All the way through with interviews. Like, that makes no sense. If you explained Harry Met Sally to someone who'd never seen When Harry Met Sally.
Yeah.
It actually, and the more I think about it, the more I think it's got a really Nora Ephron sensibility and just like, these things happen, I guess. Like, You've Got Mail, a weird book where it's just like, and then you were in love, even though he sabotaged your career, and also your shop closed. So,
well,
The whole narrative thrust was you trying to keep your shop open, but you lost to capitalism in the end. But it's okay because you get a new
job. But it's okay. One of my most unpopular opinions is that I prefer You've Got Mail to When Harry Met Sally, and I'm not going to apologise for it. Okay, well, Eloise Bridger, you're currently locked inside your house, as I am mine. Do you have anything that you're plugging that people can get on Kindle or deliver to their home?
My book, Midnight Chicken and Other yes. Recipes Worth Living For, is available on Kindle, and you should buy it. If you want to see some of the recipes first, I've put all of the store cupboard ones up on my Instagram, which is just my name. I have a poetry book called Set Me on Fire, which is other people's poems, not mine, which is why I can plug it cheerfully and happily. And there is a whole section in there called Poems for the End of the World, some of which are also on my Instagram. You should follow me on Instagram, obviously, for all the hot content. Am I plugging anything else? Car, am I? No, just being indoors a lot, to be honest.
Just being remaining indoors.
Indoors.
I now have to, I've reached that point of the calendar where I have to start plugging my second book, Scenes of a Graphic Nature, which for the eagle-eyed listeners and readers will notice a very interesting allusion to Brother of the More Famous Jack in the acknowledgement section. I'll say no more.
It's dedicated to me, Carl. Come on. You've got to put that in there.
I mean, that's in there too. Yeah.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me about the podcast at ZaroLineO'Donoghue@gmail.com. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast, thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.